The Catholics in Congonhas do Campo were especially uneasy about intrusion by the Spiritists, whether Umbanda, Quimbanda, or Cardesist, and fidgeted uneasily when there were any but minor stirrings along these lines. Arago began to notice his fourth cousin, Arlette André, in the early part of 1943, and fell in love with her. When they were married later that year, there was great rejoicing in his family, because Arlette was also an intensely devout Catholic, as well as being a graceful and intelligent girl. By this time Arago, at the age of 25, had left the confinement of his father at EMS Farm in favor of working in a local iron mine, where his strength and muscles could serve him well. Arago would rise in the chill of the plateau mornings at 3, for the mines where he worked were a dozen kilometers away, about 7.5 miles. He and most of his fellow miners would walk this distance each day, both going to and coming back from work. For their efforts, they would receive a meager wage and massive calluses on their hands from swinging a pick all day. Working conditions were brutal. Most of the miners could not make ends meet. Some of them, Arago told a friend, would bring empty lunch pails to work so they could disguise the fact that they were without money to buy food. Arago burned with a strong sense of justice, and his indignation grew until, as the newly elected president of the union local, he sparked the workers into action. The result was a strike, led by Arago. Even though Brasil at EMS 1946 constitution protected the right of workers to strike, both the federal and state governments reserved the right to declare strikes illegal, without the inconvenience of observing due process. The common theory behind such action was that anyone who stirred up a strike was likely to be a communist. Whether he was a communist or not, he was likely to be declared so. Arago was not, but the police moved in anyway. He was fired, but he resolved that he would continue to fight the 62 injustices he and his fellow miners had suffered. His wife Arlette stood by him firmly and took in work as a seamstress. His father also came to his support, and was able to set Arago up in a tavern-restaurant combination in the village, which became known as Bar du Arago. In a way, it flourished. Arago at EMS popularity drew a brisk trade. But his generosity worked against him. He could not resist lending money to a friend, or giving food to a stranger. He extended credit liberally, and not at all wisely. All the money he borrowed from his father went into the restaurant bar. Very little was left for living, but he and Arlette and their growing family managed to survive in the little old house on the Rue Maréchal Floriano. Arago kept afloat, his business buttressed by the considerable number of tourists who came to see the dramatic statues of Élie Jadenau. But as his children continued to arrive in quick succession, he began having persistent and disturbing dreams. In them, the same guttural voice kept talking to him, in a language that sounded like German, which he had heard spoken at times but could not understand. His dreams were sometimes accompanied by blinding headaches, which woke him up and from which he could find no relief. As his fears increased, he came to dread the nighttime. He wanted to keep his anguish to himself, but finally had to confide in Arlette that he could not sleep at night. At times he would have to cry out in agony. Rather than disturb Arlette, he would dress and walk the streets of the town until the pain subsided. Other nights, Arlette would wake to find him crying beside her in the bed. One night an unusually vivid dream came to him, so vivid that he could not get it out of his mind. The scene was an operating room. There was a group of doctors and nurses gathered around a patient on the table, all dressed in surgical gowns. They seemed to be working with surgical instruments on the patient, meticulously, endlessly. Directing the procedure was a rather stout, bald man who was speaking to the others in the same accent and tone as the voice that had been plaguing him for so long. What disturbed Arago so much was not the scene itself, but its utter reality. He could not separate it from the actual. And night after night, the same dream returned. In spite of this, he was able to block the dream from his thoughts when daylight came. His business was taking a turn for the better. He was able to buy some real estate, and dabbled in the used car business with moderate success. Whenever the constantly repeating dream and the blinding headaches reached crescendo, he would climb the cobblestone hill to the Church of Bum Jesus and pray. It wasn't long until a night came when the dream shifted from a nightmare to a full-scale hallucination. The fat, bald-headed doctor identified himself as Dr. Adolfo Fritz. In the hallucination, he told Arago that he had died during the First World War and that his work on Earth had never been completed. He had observed Arago for a long time and knew of his generosity and love for his fellow man. He had chosen Arago as the living vessel to carry on his work, with the help of other spirits who were doctors before they died. If Arago was to find any peace, he would have to begin serving the sick and disturbed people who needed him. Arago was to take a crucifix he had found on his father at EMS farm some time before and hold it in his hand. In this way, he would cure sick. The doctor standing before him was so real, the instructions so far-fetched, and the fear so great within Arago that he leapt up from the bed and went screaming, naked, through the streets of the village. Within moments a crowd had gathered, and Arlit ran out of the house after him. He was led gently back toward his house by several friends who had been brought to the street by his cries. He was sobbing and barely coherent. The situation was obviously serious. Back in his house, Arago grew calmer, while Dr. Venceslao de Souza Coimbra, the family doctor, was summoned. The doctor could find nothing wrong physically and prescribed a sedative. He felt, however, that Arago should receive immediate psychiatric attention. Arago agreed completely. He was now convinced that he was having delusions and that he was utterly unable to combat them by himself. Father Pinedo, a parish 64 priest, was also summoned, and prayed with him. The priest listened attentively as Arago described his strange dreams and hallucinations. If Father Pinedo was more than attentive to the substance of that night at EMS dream and to the advice given to Arago by the strange German doctor to go out and heal the sick, there was good reason for it. The Catholic Church, in Congonhas as elsewhere, was touchy about the whole idea of spiritism making any inroads among the people, whether it involved the crudities of Quimbanda or the intellectualism of the Kardecists. So far, Congonhas had remained mostly free of this disturbing influence, a condition devoutly wished for by the Catholic clergy. What Arago was telling Father Pinedo about the dreams and hallucinations was alarming because it was indicative of what many spiritist healers had claimed was a sign of the development of a medium. Arago was a solid Catholic. He knew little or nothing about Kardec. With his peculiar, untutored charisma, he could become dangerous to the church establishment if he leaned toward the work of a healer or a medium. Father Pinedo warned Arago of this danger, and told him that he would immediately arrange for both medical and psychiatric examinations in Belo Horizonte. Arago was more than willing. He went the next day for a complete physical examination, including x-rays and blood tests, in the nearby city. He had a long consultation with a psychiatrist. Neither doctor could find anything particularly disturbing. His physical health seemed excellent. His psychiatric examination showed no signs of manifest psychosis, or even neurosis. Follow-up examinations confirmed the original conclusions. But the headaches, dreams, and hallucinations continued. In spite of the anguish and distraction they brought, Arago continued building his business and even started to dabble in local politics. He was still smarting from the injustices he had found as a miner, and felt the only way he could combat these was to support the cause of labor both nationally and locally. He continued consulting with Father Pinedo and other members of the clergy, and 65, continued seeing a doctor. No evident physical symptoms showed up. Occasionally, during the day, he would have a brief fainting spell, blacking out and remembering nothing afterward. He became convinced he was going insane, and pleaded with both the priests and the doctor to help him further. At length, because the nature of the hallucinations suggested the possibility of possession, Father Pinedo decided on the need for the exorcising ritual of the church. It was carried out with all the ancient and elaborate ceremony that had characterized the process back through the history of the Catholic Church, the burning of incense, the chanting of litanies and adjurations, the blessing of the house to free the sufferer from evil spirits. Apparently the spirits were not listening, because the ritual did not work. On the other hand, the dreams and hallucinations did not seem to involve evil spirits. If anything, the attitude of the alleged Dr. Fritz was benevolent. But Arago was literally exhausted from resisting the German doctor of the spirit world. Whatever anyone else thought, the events that were plaguing Arago were inescapably real to him. Almost out of desperation, he wondered what might happen if he gave in to the intransigent demands of the so-called Dr. Fritz. He had a chance to try shortly later. He encountered a friend of his who was a cripple, who walked on crutches and received much sympathy from the citizens of the town. Hardly thinking before he spoke, Arago found himself blurting out in his rough hewn way, "A mess about time you got rid of those crutches at M." He grabbed them from the man and told him to walk. The man did so, and continued to remain able to do so. Far from relieving his mind, the incident filled Arago with more fear. If all this were true, he was being shouldered with an enormous responsibility which he had no rational way of carrying out. In addition, he had been warned by Father Pinedo about Spiritism and the Kardecist philosophy, and had no desire to go against the tenets of the Church. In spite of his fear, and very tentatively, he tried again with some other friends who were sick with 66 varied complaints, simply by using verbal commands to them. They reported back that whatever he had done, it had worked. But at times, he had to be told that he had issued these commands. He had no memory of them, but strangely enough, his headaches and hallucinations had stopped altogether during the few weeks he had given in to the impulse prescribed by Dr. Fritz. It was not TMT long before word spread around the town, and it brought Father Pinedo on the run. The priest spoke sharply. Arago had placed himself in direct conflict with the Church. He was already being spoken of as a curandero, the Portuguese word for quack or charlatan. Arago listened to the priest intently. He was anything but a rebel as far as the Church was concerned. Further, he was repelled by what the priests had told him about Spiritism. It was a heresy of the First Order, and should be avoided at all costs. He confessed to his weakness in giving into the instructions of Dr. Fritz, and agreed to stop. One of the first steps he took was to put up a prominent sign on his door, "In this house, we are all Catholics, Spiritism is a thing of the devil." Alit, whose concern had been growing even more than Arago at EMS, was pleased with this action. Perhaps now they would have some peace. But this had no sooner been done when Arago at EMS dreams, hallucinations, and headaches returned with a fury, along with the daytime blackouts, in which his memory was wiped out for the duration. There were more visits to Belo Horizonte, this time to several doctors and psychiatrists, but the image of Dr. Fritz became more insistent. While all this turmoil did not at first affect the business at his restaurant, Arago was very concerned about what it would mean to his political aspirations. He knew enough about his own motives to know that his political hopes were not slanted for personal gain, but arose from a real and almost irresistible impulse to help his fellow man. This was no casual idealistic impulse. In fact, he found it a distinct liability at times, and he worried about it. He had many friends who worked in a local factory that was experiencing shaky financial times. Many of them were 67, worried about the plant closing, and Arago offered them almost unlimited credit. He did the same for many others, and could not resist lending money to almost anyone who asked for it. He was not a good businessman, and after a short period of burgeoning prosperity, he was alarmed to discover that he was heading for financial disaster. In spite of this, he gathered and bought clothing for the poor and their children on dozens of occasions. Now he was faced with this new and unsought thrust from a Dr. Fritz at TM, and his conscience was caught in a squeeze between an obsessional drive of unknown dimensions and the Catholic Church, which would look on him as a heretic if he yielded to this undefined impetus. He was in this state of confusion in 1950, at the age of 32, when Senator Bittencourt had arrived in town to solicit his political support. The memory of all these chaotic scenes was in his mind as he drove his jeep back toward Congonhas. However deep his concern for his fellow man, Arago always drove with utter disregard for life and limb. In Brazil, as in nearly all developing countries, awareness of the deadliness of the motor vehicle has not yet set in spite of the frequent bloody and harrowing accidents that strew the roads. His tension and worry from the incident in the hotel room with Senator Bittencourt were terrifying, and he was again tormented by the fear that he was on the verge of insanity. As he screeched around the hairpin turns of the road to Congonhas, he searched his mind trying to remember if he actually had gone into the senatorial mess room with his razor and done what the senator said he had done. He could remember none of it. His razor was in its regular place when he packed to leave. There was no evidence of blood on it. He had had only two glasses of wine to drink, and had clearly remembered going to bed and starting to go to sleep. His next memory was of the senator pounding on the door and asking him to go with him to get a cup of tea. What might happen after Senator Bittencourt's TMS plane reached Rio brought Arago more terror? Suppose the senator brought charges against him? What if the A-Operation TM-68 caused him to die? What would Bittencourt's TMS doctor say when he saw what had happened? That the operation had taken place could not be denied. And, with a long history of his curandero impulses recorded among the villagers and in the files of the church and the below horizonte doctors, it would be logical for them to assume that Arago had done the operation, even though he did not TMT recall it at all. The whole problem had reached a new intensity, and he did not know how to cope with it. It was a confused and disarrayed Arago who arrived in Congonhas do Campo later that morning. His most pressing decision was whether he should tell anyone about what had happened. Both Arlete and Father Pinedo would be totally distraught if he told them, and the town would be in an uproar. There was already too much talk around the town about the puzzling cures that had resulted from his previous actions. He struggled with the decision to tell or not to tell, but could not bring himself to make it. In a very short time, the decision was made for him. Incredible news arrived from Senator Bittencourt. He had gone immediately from the airport to his doctor in Rio. He had been examined, the wound probed, and x-rays taken. Because of the strangeness of what had happened in the hotel room in below horizonte, he had shrunk at first from telling his doctor anything until the examination was complete. He merely had mentioned that he had been operated on. The Rio doctor, assuming that the operation had been done in the United States, as he had instructed, glowed with satisfaction about the results of the x-rays. He explained to the senator that the tumor had been cleanly removed by a very unusual surgical technique that did not seem to be known in Brazil. As far as he could tell, the prognosis should be excellent. Yet before the operation, he had been very pessimistic, and frankly did not think that Senator Bittencourt had much longer to live. He would follow up with further tests, but the picture had changed from one of complete despair to unqualified optimism. It was then that the senator told the doctor what had happened. The doctor listened, incredulous. He found it 69, impossible to believe. But Senator Bittencourt insisted, and the doctor was forced to accept the explanation. If this was true A and the doctor had confidence in the senatorial's veracity A, there would have to be some sort of study to verify the medical skills of this rare curandero. Either that or the Brazilian Medical Association would have to take action against him. In the meantime, the fact remained that Senator Lúcio Bittencourt was a well man, and if the future tests turned out to be as favorable as the doctor was confident they would be, the senator would remain in good health indefinitely. The additional tests were favorable, and Bittencourt was not one to keep a good thing quiet. After dispatching the incredible news to Congonhas do Campo, he told the story to everyone who would listen. Within days, it spread across the press in all of Brazil. In Congonhas do Campo, Arago became a folk hero overnight, to the consternation and distress of both the church and his family. Arago protested that he was not at all sure he had done such an operation, that the incident, if it happened, was just one more of a long string that was bringing him nothing but anxiety and apprehension. The immoderate exuberance of Senator Bittencourt was matched by the towering disapproval of the church. Father Pinedo took Arago in hand and reminded him of his promise to stop such behavior. Things had now gone too far. Arago protested that it was impossible to stop what he never remembered doing, or what he was not conscious of doing. He had not knowingly, he assured the priest, done anything whatever to violate his promise. The situation presented a baffling point of order, and strained the competence of Father Pinedo in trying to come up with a viable answer. The problem was almost imponderable and raised the specter of spiritism where it was least welcome. Disturbed as she was, Arlette comforted, supported, and ministered to her disquieted husband. His life seemed to be piling up with a series of crises, involving his business, his political hopes, and his psychological stability. Meanwhile, the hallucinations featuring Dr. Fritz would not let up, and they gave him no surcease. Because of 70, Arago at EMS base at honesty and charisma, the villagers for the most part stood behind him as loyally as his wife. Senator Bittencourt returned to the town with lavish praise for Arago at EMS' inconceivable surgical prowess, which encouraged the small spiritist group in town to become more vocal and conspicuous. They felt that spiritism was the only possible explanation of the seeming miracle that Arago had performed. They claimed that Arago was a bona fide medium who had not yet realized his potential. The spiritists went even further. They claimed that during some of their mediumistic sessions they carried on in the intellectualized card tradition, and strictly without umbrella rituals of any kind a Dr. Adolfo Fritz had made himself known to them. He told them that he had spent 16 years preparing Arago to carry on the work of healing. The discarnate German doctor, allegedly speaking through the medium, said that he had been working on a medium up north in Bahia, but that the man did not have Arago at EMS selfless qualities and would be likely to turn his talents to self-aggrandizement, to say nothing of commercial advantage. Since one of the strict rules of the Kardec philosophy is that no healer can accept any money for his work, Dr. Fritz had turned to Arago, whom he was sure would not violate that principle. When told of this theory, Arago dismissed it. The little he knew about mediums came from the pungent warnings of Father Pinedo, and he would have none of it. Still distressed, he tried to continue his ordinary routine in the face of the fast-moving events that were overrunning his life. He tried to assume a posture of normalcy, difficult as it was. Not all the Catholic clergy were as severe as the official position of the Church itself. Padre Pascal, who had taught Arago his first catechism, was particularly fond of him, and felt that he had spiritual qualities of great depth and beauty. The padre had been a chaplain in World War II and had observed many strange things on the battlefield that could not be explained. As a result, he had studied hypnotism and parapsychology. He was convinced that Arago was undergoing some kind of parapsychologic experience that was worthy of extensive study. He comforted 71, Arago, asked him to have faith and courage. A God puts things in the right place at the right time, etm, he told Arago. A he writes straight things in curved liners, etm. The consternation that swept the streets of the village when Senator Bittencourt brought his astounding medical news reverberated everywhere. Jose A. Tilda Copyright Diacona, mayor of Congonhas, had grown up with Arago in the village. He tried to piece together the background of his friend to explain the phenomenon that seemed to be growing into a modern legend. But he could find little to explain the roots of Arago at EMS' mysterious powers. Arago had always held his friends spellbound with stories and anecdotes, always seemed to have a fresh viewpoint on everything. He was always bursting with great good humor, and constantly joking with his friends. The mayor couldn't at EMT resist the temptation of wondering whether all the recent happenings were not just one of Arago at EMS jokes. Whatever it was, the mayor was convinced of Arrigo Atm's basic goodness and his unqualified affection for other people. What would follow next in this strange series of events neither he nor anyone else in the village could know. What did happen next came with such suddenness that it brought one of the biggest shockwaves that Kangonhas Du Campo had ever experienced. The woman was very sick. She suffered from cancer of the uterus. There was no hope at all, and death was expected at any minute. She lay on her bed, surrounded by close relatives and a few friends. Candles were lit in the quiet room, and the priest arrived to administer extreme unction, the last rites of the church. The family were good friends of Arrigo, and he and Arlette called at the house to pay their last respects to the dying woman. It was a solemn scene, and a sad one. The priest completed the ritual, and quietly left. In the silence that followed, Arrigo bowed his head with the others in silent prayer. Then he began to experience a feeling which had become familiar to him, a tingling that began in his head and slowly moved down through his legs. He started to tremble and his eyes became clouded. Then, without warning, he burst into the kitchen and ran 72, back into the room in a matter of moments. There was a large kitchen knife in his hands. With a sharp, commanding voice, he ordered everyone to stand back. The gathering was frozen with terror, and did not TMT dare move. Pulling down the sheet, he spread the woman at TMS legs and plunged the knife directly into the vagina, probing violently, twisting the blade, slicing the flesh to widen the opening. A woman relative screamed and ran out of the room. The others stood transfixed. The dying woman lay quietly, unperturbed, as he continued to plunge and jab the blade mercilessly. Then he removed the blade, forced his hand into the opening, savagely twisting his wrist as he did so. In a matter of seconds he withdrew his hand, yanking out an enormous bloody uterine tumor, the size of a small grapefruit. He crossed to the kitchen, dropped the knife and the ugly flesh into the sink, and then sank down on a chair beside it. It had all happened so fast that the onlookers simply could not believe what they were seeing. There was little bleeding, beyond that on the blood-soaked tumor. One relative muttered that he was going for a doctor, and ran out. Others looked mutely, helplessly toward Arrigo, who was now holding his head in his hands and sobbing. A sister of the dying woman shook herself free from her paralysis, ran to the kitchen and returned with a basin of warm water and a washcloth. Arlette moved almost as if in a dream, and knelt beside her husband. There were tears in her eyes. Arrigo seemed to be in another world. He could hardly respond to Arlette's questions. When he seemed to have gained more control of himself, she took him by the arm and led him out of the house, still sobbing. The doctor arrived shortly afterward, and quickly examined the dying woman. He looked first for hemorrhaging, but there was none. The patient was conscious, had felt no pain, and was not at all sure what had happened to her. Her pulse and heartbeat were satisfactory. She felt no discomfort whatever, either during or after the experience. She felt only relief now. The doctor turned to the others and asked them to describe what had happened. They did so, in meticulous detail. 73. The doctor then examined the tumor. There was no question that this was a uterine tumor. What a TMS more, it was a growth that was considered to be inoperable. He wrapped it to take with him for further tests. Then he rechecked his patient. This was unquestionably the strangest medical case he had ever encountered, if not in medical history. Just what the prognosis would be for his patient, he had no possible way to determine. But the information that finally did emerge a few days later was that the patient was getting better. On the heels of Senator Bittencourt a TMS case, this news literally rocked the town. Within days, people began lining up outside Arrigo's TMS house, imploring him to treat them. Knowing the new turmoil that was now seizing the Catholic clergy, he turned to them for help and looked to the church for refuge from the clamoring demands of the sick. The church authorities pleaded, cajoled, and demanded that Arrigo not give in to the supplications. He tried to resist, but the impulse spurred by Dr. Fritz would give him no rest. And when the dying woman he had operated on rallied and was able to return to normal life, the pressure to help those who were begging for treatment became irresistible. One morning, when nearly 100 people gathered outside his door, Arago opened it and let them come in, one by one. But when he finished seeing them that day, he remembered little or nothing about what he had done. He was told that he had either written complicated prescriptions in all the proper pharmacological terms or had taken a kitchen knife or household scissors and had operated.